From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz and I discuss this week's salvaging of the Costa Concordia cruise ship off the coast of Italy. We also discuss Monday's apparent short-term failure of Iran's firewall that blocks Facebook and Twitter.
But again, this continues to really show, as you mentioned, the importance of social media, the power of social media, particularly in a part of the world where there isn't a lot of way and means to voice one's opinion.
And later, I'll talk with New Zealand filmmaker Costa Botez. He's directed documentaries about Canadian sled dogs, a cross-dressing attorney, and the inventor of the Jelly Belly jelly bean.
It does seem like a bewildering variety, doesn't it? They're all people that carry their passions forward. And another thing that they all have in common is most of them are miserably unsuccessful.
These conversations coming up after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Rebecca Cruz, a couple of interesting stories in the news. Costa Concordia, if you don't remember, the great big cruise ship that capsized off the coast of the Italian Tuscan coast. And it's been there ever since. This happened 2 years ago. It happened, in fact, while I was living there in the fall of 2011. The big news is that this week they engaged in the massive engineering undertaking to upright the boat and tow it off to where, I guess, a point where it would be destroyed. What is going on with this, and why is this a big deal?
Well, it's a big deal, first off, because the pictures are pretty striking. To see this boat uprighted after a year and a half, almost 2 years, and really they took it 65-degree angle from the ocean's floor up, so really a significant engineering feat to begin with. There's also a couple of other things going on here. You mentioned that there are about 32 victims. There was two whose bodies were never found. And so for the victims to move beyond this, the families of the victims, I should say, there is some hope that they will be able to find some of these remains. So that's part of the story. I think the other thing that's interesting here is that Italy is really looking at this as a point of pride, that they brought in a number of workers from over 26 different countries to come in and be part of this. And they are taking what was really a point of disgrace for Italy, for many of them, which really affected their image in some ways. And now they can kind of turn that around to some degree and be proud of this really significant engineering feat.
Even though it was obviously a significant disaster and one that the Italians, of course, generally were outraged by, but were left with this landmark that was, you know, a huge eyesore and a real problem for the Italian tourist community and the cruise industry, which is a massive moneymaker all around the world, but particularly for Italy, as people love to cruise the Mediterranean.
It doesn't elicit a great deal of confidence in cruise ships to be going by and seeing this this wreckage. So those that live nearby on the Tuscan coast there are very happy to see it upright. And it will be, as you mentioned, taken off, they're thinking, sometime in the next spring and will be taken apart.
But as you mentioned, the images are quite remarkable.
They really are.
So another issue in Iran this week. The Iranian government typically blocks access for Iranian citizens to Facebook, to Twitter, to social media sites. And there was, I guess, a computer glitch of some sort that allowed the Iranian public access to these very important social media sites. I mean, we've seen what social media does in other parts of the Middle East in terms of organizing protests and resistance to their governments. And so the Iranian government very, you know, cracking down on social media. But then there was like 2 hours of freedom, social media freedom, before they figured out that there was a problem. It raises issues of censorship, but also the critical importance of social media in the public life.
Well, you'll remember, Suzette, that this really occurred in 2009, surrounding the Iranian elections that year that were so contentious, the so-called Green Revolution. This is also often called the Twitter Revolution, because that was really the first time where we started seeing that Twitter could have an impact. And certainly a couple years later with the Arab Spring, or again, so-called Arab Spring, we saw that in full force. So the Iranian officials were pretty diligent in keeping Facebook and Twitter blocked. There were some ways around it, but there is a kind of cyber security police that goes around around warning Iranian citizens not to try to go around that. There's a little bit of unclarity in terms of what did happen on Monday. There are many people that got on social media and were ecstatic that this had happened. They thought this was going to be a long-term deal. The new president there has often mentioned that he will lift some of these restrictions. So whether this was a glitch, which is the official declaration by the government, or whether this was some sort of test.
Like a trial balloon. Let's float it. Let's see what happens for a couple hours. And apparently they weren't satisfied weren't satisfied with the outcome and decided to shut it down.
Right. So we're not sure what this means or what this is going to do going forward. But again, this continues to really show, as you mentioned, the importance of social media, the power of social media, particularly in a part of the world where there isn't a lot of way and means to voice one's opinion.
Well, definitely an interesting story. A couple of stories this week in the international news. And Rebecca, thank you so much for telling us about these stories.
Thank you.
If you have any thoughts about this program or a question for Rebecca or me, leave a comment on the Worldviews page of KGOU.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU. Next, my conversation with New Zealand filmmaker Costa Botes. He was in Oklahoma last week to screen his 2011 film, The Last Dogs of Winter, which looks at the breeding of Inuit dogs in northern Canada. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. My guest is film director and writer Costa Botes. He grew up in New Zealand and is a longtime associate and friend of Peter Jackson, the director of the hugely successful Lord of the Rings trilogy. He spent 5 years producing and directing a behind-the-scenes look at the Academy Award-winning adaptation of the fantasy novels. Botes is probably best known for his 1995 documentary produced with Jackson called Forgotten Silver, about a New Zealand film industry pioneer that turned out to be an elaborate hoax. Costa Botes, welcome to Worldviews.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Well, I have to start by just asking about your very interesting international background. You were born in Turkey to Greek parents, but you grew up in New Zealand. Can you give us a little bit of kind of your own personal history of how you ended up in all of these interesting places?
Well, my family are from an island off the coast of Turkey, and it was essentially a Greek island. And in the 1920s, after the huge war between Greece and Turkey, the boundaries were redrawn, and we found ourselves on the Turkish side. So my parents were actually Turkish citizens, but ethnically they're Greek. And in the 1950s, the Greeks on that island, they were pretty much the last holdouts. A lot of Greeks moved. A lot of Greeks were slaughtered. There was mass slaughter. My lot were pretty much the last to leave. And most of the Greeks left this island during the 1950s and 1960s. And my father went to New Zealand. And my mother and I followed a year or two later. And so at the age of three, I found myself in a country where I couldn't speak the language. Mm-hmm. And grew up, with all the sort of hang-ups that an immigrant kid has. And I mean, I value it now. At the time, it seemed quite traumatic, but it gave me a perspective that's different. So
speaking of that then, tell me, how does that perspective differ, given a very significant international background that is, as you mentioned, kind of quite traumatic to begin with? How does that differ? And then how does that relate to the profession that you ultimately chose to get into, which is filmmaking?
Wow, that's a big question. Well, you grow up in a conformist society that is largely white and English. And the very fact that you speak a different language and don't understand English gives you automatically a kind of outsider perspective. And I grew up wanting to conform, and that meant that my links to my own culture were not severed, but they were stretched to breaking point. And to this day, I speak Greek, but I don't really identify as Greek. And I think it was probably not until my 30s when I finally felt I was comfortable in my own skin.
Yeah.
So as a filmmaker, that drives all kind of attitudes. And it means, you know, you're always on the outside looking at characters and how they fit. And I feel quite comfortable in my own skin now, finally. But, you know,
As a Kiwi.
Yeah. I didn't feel like a Kiwi until I went back to where I was born. And that didn't happen until I was in my mid-30s. And as I flew back to New Zealand and we, you know, flew over the green hills and I looked down and I thought, ah, finally now I know where home is.
Well, so I think something you just said is very enlightening in terms of how it relates to that film career, and that is being an outsider in some ways. I mean, as a filmmaker, you stand behind a camera. You are trying to articulate a vision of some sort of whatever it is you're trying to portray to the viewing audience at some point in time as kind of that outsider, right, that outsider perspective that you bring to it. So your background and what you decided to do with your life seems to be pretty consistent in that way.
I've always looked at the world and tried to put a frame around it, partly to understand it. But there's also an aesthetic dimension there too, you know, to make pictures that look nice. But to give my point of view, I mean, you know, as a young child, my voice was muffled. I couldn't make myself understood. I didn't understand other people. And so I was always looking for ways to, you know, to communicate better. And cinema made a strong impact on me at that age. So it was imprinted on me really early. As I got to adolescence, I discovered a talent for taking photographs. So imagery was quite important to me. I love books, literature, ideas. It all leads inexorably to film because film combines everything, pictures, ideas, poetry, music. I'm very much into music. And film is the one art form that is a synthesis of all those things.
To bring that together, to tell us a story and entertain us even. But, clearly you've done some work in feature film making. You were involved as any good Kiwi, I suppose, would be in the Fellowship of the Ring and the series there. But I really want to talk about your documentary work because that seems to be where you've spent most of your time, and particularly your choice of subjects when you do documentary work. I have to admit this is I'm so intrigued by the fact you've done documentary films about Canadian Eskimo dogs, about the creator of the Jelly Belly jelly bean, about a bipolar writer and a cross-dressing attorney. So, I mean, what is the common theme here, or what has motivated you to select these particular projects focus on in your work?
It does seem like a bewildering variety, doesn't it? There is a common theme, and the common theme is that all of these characters have carried a passion for a long, long time. They're all persistent in either their vision or the thing that they love, the thing that they want to achieve, and they're not quitters, I suppose. They're all people that carry their passions forward. And another thing that they all have in common is most of them are miserably unsuccessful in traditional terms. They either don't make much money or they haven't made much money, and that makes them outsiders of a sort too. I think our culture tends to value people according to how much money they make. And I couldn't help but notice the film review in the local paper here. It didn't say anything about the actual film. All it talked about was how much it made. And I think that's a slightly askew world. And I don't, you know, I want to celebrate something else. I want to celebrate people for reasons other than what they're worth financially.
I'm speaking with Costa Botes, a documentary filmmaker from New Zealand who was born in Turkey to ethnically Greek parents. More of our conversation right after a break. I'm Suzette Grolot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews on KGOU. I'm Suzette Grolot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. My guest, Costa Botes, has written, produced, and directed several documentaries about characters he just called passionate, but not necessarily prosperous financially. So you're selecting your subjects then basically to highlight successful people who are perhaps achieving success in some other way and also seem to be a bit eclectic, or as you mentioned, they're not quitters. They're, I don't know, extreme cases of individuals. So tell us, for example, about Brian Ledoux, the rather extreme personality your film about the Canadian Eskimo dogs and the work that he did to breed these dogs.
Well, Last Dogs of Winter is about an individual who can best be described as incredibly stubborn. He works and lives in an environment that is beyond extreme, and he's trying to do something that is probably impossible. He's trying to preserve and breed a breed of dog, which, you know, for a long time was the indigenous dog of the Arctic. The Inuit bred them, and the whole purpose of those dogs has disappeared. We don't need them anymore. They used to do everything with human beings up there. They helped people stay alive up there. They dragged their sleds. They hunted. They were an absolutely essential part of life for human beings in the Arctic, And then in the 1950s, with the arrival of petrol power, the whole purpose of those dogs disappeared. So Brian is trying to do something utterly quixotic. He's, you know, and almost pointless. And there's a real drama to that.
So you're right. I mean, that's kind of an obsolete animal at this point in time, if you want to put it that way. But it has a connection to the preservation of a particular kind of culture and way of life and indigenous practices. I mean, is that something that also motivated him to do that and perhaps motivated you to tell a story about it?
This particular character, Brian Ladoon, I think he's motivated by a very personal and selfish passion. I don't think he thinks too much about the wider cultural implications, but they are there all the same. A limitation of my film is my focus is on Brian as a character, and there's a much wider story there, and because those dogs are actually a very critical part of Inuit culture, and Inuit are reclaiming them now, finally, again, and using them to resuscitate a highly damaged culture. I didn't feel it was my place as someone from, you know, 24,000 miles away to jump into that. And I wasn't able to physically either. I would have had to travel even further afield and spend much longer to do that. But I didn't feel that was my place. I was interested in one character who I had access to, and there was actually quite a big story there anyway, and that's what the focus of my film was.
Well, it seems like that's the focus of most of your films. Again, I'm particularly curious about, I love Jelly Belly Jelly Beans, so what is it about the creator of the Jelly Belly Jelly Bean that was intriguing enough for you to produce a documentary film about him?
That film's called Candyman, the David Klein story. David Klein is the man who in 1976 invented the Jelly Belly Jelly Bean, and in the process revolutionized an entire industry. In the first minute of the film, he's sitting in the back of his car, and he says, "Jelly Belly, they ruined my life." And I think there's the story. The fact that something
just the opposite for me, right?
The fact that something silly like a jelly bean can ruin your life, or as he puts it. It's one of those stories where somebody comes up with something amazing that no one's ever done before, makes a lot of money, and then through a combination of foolishness and manipulation and bad luck, ends up losing it. And that's the sort of surface story. But the real story is actually him and his son. It's a father and son story, because that jelly belly played a big role in ruining the relationship between David and his son. And what happens in the movie is the son rediscovers his father and forgives him. And that makes it quite a moving tale.
So is that something that you can capture, you think, through documentary filmmaking, real life stories where you can truly show this kind of underlying theme, in this case, the relationship between father and son, more so than you can do in a feature film? It's more real. It's something we can relate to better.
Well, feature films can give you an amazing platform for creating emotion and meaning, and they're fantastic, but they're expensive to make. And number one. And number two, certainly in the mainstream commercial cinema, the boundaries of what's acceptable have become very inflexible. You're just simply not allowed to tell stories in too many different ways. It's very boring, but that's the way it is. Whereas in documentary, what we see is audiences, I guess because they're smaller for a start and they're more niche, they're prepared to accept more flexible ways of telling stories. So what we see, I personally think that documentary is right on the bleeding edge of the art form at the moment. It has been for years. It's where the really innovative and interesting work is going on. And so you have a lot more license to explore things creatively. And you can still, you know, tell a dramatic story. That's what I try and do. You can still tell an emotional story. And again, I definitely try and do that. I want to move you. That's the number one thing. And if you do that well, then you can actually make people think a little bit as well. But
well, I just want to, referring to kind of what I'm, if I'm hearing you correctly, kind of this formula that comes with feature filmmaking, and that, as you're, I think you're referring to the lack of flexibility and that there's some sort of formula you must follow in order to make a feature film, as opposed to kind of things maybe emerging a little more organically by telling a story that's real in a documentary film. Is this kind of what you're intimating?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
And again, so it's successful. I mean, I guess that's the connection to it, is if for a feature film to be successful, they're expensive to make, therefore they have to make money. Mm. They must follow a formula in order to be successful, whereas that's not the case perhaps in documentary film.
It's not so much that they have to follow a formula, but audiences aren't really prepared to accept by and large, stories that don't follow a classical three-act structure. I mean, we know this just by observation. Well, just telling a story in three-act structure doesn't make it successful. There's plenty of flops that follow that formula. So there's a kind of dilemma there. On the one hand, you want to be creative, you want to be authentic, you want to be truly emotional, you want to tell the truth, because audiences value all those things. But I guess the big commercial bodies that make films don't really value those things. They value the bottom line. They're there to make a profit. So you have a constant seesaw. I just think something's a little bit out of whack in the commercial cinema. I've got no bone really to pick with Hollywood particularly, but they do dominate the whole world. You know, 97% of the world box office goes to Hollywood. That's a pretty small area to be hoovering up 97% of the world box office. And, yeah, they push formulas and very narrow range of thinking going on there.
Well, that's where I kind of wanted to end today, was with the kind of the global nature of filmmaking. And I think you touched on it right there, and that is the dominance of one type of film in the global film market, and therefore one formula and one, you know, city or one country, certainly American film being very dominant around the world. So do you see documentary film as being more popular in other parts of the world than here, or is that going to be hard to counter?
Well, for years now, documentary film has been popular. People are interested. We see this in film festivals, and certainly in my country, documentaries regularly play in cinemas. But unfortunately, there is a but. It's very, very hard to monetize documentaries. Like, they're much, much cheaper to make than feature films, dramas. But all the same, the returns are very, very low. And we've seen a steady, inexorable kind of collapse in the financial market for all kinds of films, actually, not just documentaries. So it's quite worrying. At the same time, I don't see any collapse in the market in terms of people's demand for film. We need stories. We've always needed stories. But we're seeing, I hope, a short-term problem. It's really caused by the internet piracy, freeloading, all that kind of nonsense. And it's hurting us badly right now. But I'm hoping in the foreseeable future that there will be a recovery and the internet will actually give more than it takes.
Well, Costa Botes, thank you so much for being with us today on Worldviews to share this very interesting story and perspective.
Thank you very much.
That was my conversation with New Zealand documentary filmmaker Costa Botes. You can watch the trailer for his 2011 film, The Last Dogs of Winter, and see a slideshow of the film's production on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews with the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Hillary Gibson prepared the research for this interview, and Brian Hardzinski records and edits the audio. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Grelott.